Mr. Fink arrived? Okay, we'll proceed then to hear argument in the case of National Union Fire versus Travelers Indemnity et al., appeal number 072848. Mr. Fink.
May it please the Court, Matthew Fink on behalf of National Union. Again, I apologize to the Court for showing up late. I had the wrong time, but appreciate putting us back to the next call. I'd like to address two central issues on the appeal. The District Court's construction of the excess policy as it relates to coverage for post-judgment interest, and then the Court's alternative ruling that the granting summary judgment finding that National Union had assumed Rockwell's defense. I'd first like to focus on the contract construction. The District Court had adopted the reasoning in Hooters that post-judgment interest is covered only when an insurer is defending, because the Court said this is the only way to harmonize the insuring agreement with the defense provision. Court's reasoning is flawed because there is another way to interpret the two policies in order to work in harmony and give effect to all the policy provisions. Simply, the insuring agreement provides coverage for those sums that the insured comes legally obligated to pay. Post-judgment interest is part of the sums that the insured becomes legally obligated to pay to the claimant. The defense agreement, separate insuring agreement for supplemental coverage, provides additional coverage. If the insurer is defending, then post-judgment interest is covered, but it does not exhaust the limits of liability. It has to be paid in addition to the limits of liability. On the other hand, if the insurer does not defend, then post-judgment interest is still covered as a legal obligation owed to the claimant, but does not exhaust the limits of the policy. It goes directly towards the limits of the policy.
Just so we have some better background here, what was this thing ultimately settled for?
Well, it was settled for the judgment.
The judgment was reinstated, the full amount was paid, you were on the hook for $50 million, and then the other umbrella policies kicked in their proportion. So I would imagine then, looking at this, that the Travelers didn't have to pay anything.
Travelers, the next layer, Federal is the next layer. They paid most of their policy limits, and there was about $3 million left in their policy limits, and then Gulf, for the Travelers, Gulf, above paid nothing because their limits had not been reached. And
right.
What was at dispute then was the post-judgment interest, which was over $18 million.
$18 million in post-judgment interest, and the issue then is whether you are obligated to pay that over and above the policy limits that you've already paid.
Exactly, whether it's a supplemental payment or, as Rockwell originally had contended in the case, that it's covered within all the insurance policies in their insuring agreement, and would have to go straight up through all the coverage. They had $150 million of coverage.
And there is no dispute, though, that you assumed the defense, and whether that means you're on the hook for all the interest is another issue, I assume. But you agree that you did assume the defense, and it looked like you had the lion's share of all the early exposure rests with you.
No, we did not agree that we assumed the defense. National Union had not assumed the defense of the case. That's what the court found, and that was an error. They found that in summary judgment. There was conflicting evidence on that and a genuine issue of dispute that National Union was participating in the defense, but they never assumed control of the defense. If they had assumed control of the defense, then there's no disagreement that they would be obligated then to pay all the post-judgment interest under their policy. But since they did not assume the defense of the case, then the post-judgment interest just becomes a legal obligation that was owed to the claimant, falls within the insuring agreements of all of the insurers, and would go straight up the ladder and into the Travelers policy.
Who do you think, if anybody, assumed the defense of Rockwell here?
Well, the starting point of this is that Rockwell had the obligation to
defend itself. They're self-insured for $2 million, and then there's a million that kicks in with Travelers, but then the next $50 million is your company.
Right.
So you have I would think, looking at this gigantic loss, have a great interest in wanting to control how the defense is being orchestrated.
there's no doubt that there was a potential exposure and an interest to be involved in the case, and that's why National Union did participate in the defense of the case by first hiring a firm to help with the trial of the case. But again, you know, you have to go back to the starting point of control of the defense of the case means who has the right to have the ultimate decision-making power in the case, make strategic litigation decisions. Who really has the veto power? If there is a disagreement, who has that right to say, no, this is the way we're going to do this. This is the attorney we're going to hire. I don't care.
But who could have made a decision to, say, settle this case for $45 million?
Well, settlement's a different thing than defense of the case. The issues on the settlement of the case had to be a participation of everybody because the last demand was $150 million, so it would have taken everybody's participation to settle the case. But with respect to the...
Well, but also, wasn't National in the game because it helped choose appellate counsel, paid all the fees as well?
You know, there was a disputed question of fact as to whether they selected the appellate counsel. There was evidence in the record that, in fact, ultimate appellate counsel Robertson was first suggested by Rockwell, and it was recommended by Rockwell's counsel that Ms. Robertson be retained. There was no disagreement then between National Union and Rockwell as to hiring this appellate counsel, but it doesn't mean that National Union selected that counsel. Again, I think you need to go back to the starting point here, which is that Rockwell itself, under the self-insured retention, had the obligation, the right and obligation, to control its own defense. National Union, or any excess insurer, doesn't have the right just to come in and hijack the defense of the case and take it over without the consent of Rockwell. It's Rockwell's right. Likewise, Rockwell can't just dump or tender its defense onto an excess insurer because Rockwell has that obligation to continue to defend the case even through the appeal. There has to be some evidence that there was an agreement or understanding between Rockwell and National Union that there was going to be a transfer of the defense in the case. And, you know, sometimes that does happen because there is an excess insurer has a large interest. But other times it doesn't. The self-insured or the primary continues to have the obligation to defend the case. And the excess insurer, as in this case, still participates in that defense by hiring additional counsel or by working with counsel. But the important point is that there was no evidence in the record that there was ever any understanding between Rockwell and National Union that there was going to be a transfer of the control of the defense of the case. In fact, the evidence is that there was a genuine issue of disputed fact on that. National Union submitted evidence in a May 11, 2004 email, which is at record 51-5. That was an email from National Union to Rockwell, where National Union reiterated its position that although it had paid for the earlier Clausen firm to come in and just assist with trial counsel, that it had not addressed yet who was going to be controlling the defense of the appeal, and in fact said that we have not changed any of the contractual arrangements, that meaning that Rockwell still had the obligation to defend the entire case.
At that stage of the appeal, the court had reduced the judgment down, what was it, 190 or something like that? What was on appeal? What was the status of the case when it went on appeal?
The status of the case is that it had been reduced to $190,000, and the plaintiff...
From $97 million or something.
Correct.
Like that. Yeah.
Around that.
So, theoretically, at least, you could say Rockwell was trying to... would have reason to prevent any further exposure. They would have paid less if it was only $190,000. I guess that's what you're arguing. I'm not sure, because clearly, on appeal, this is a substantial... issue, and what happened on appeal, they reinstated the $97 million.
Right.
So there was a big, the appeal was a big deal.
Right, and we're not contending that otherwise. I think everyone realized that there was a large exposure one way if the appeal was reversed. But the important point is, you know, there's still that Rockwell had the obligation and the right to continue to defend themselves unless there was an agreement to transfer that, and there has to be evidence that there is an agreement to transfer that to National Union. It doesn't just transfer because National Union has more exposure than Rockwell. The obligation to defend and control the defense still remained with Rockwell. Now, you know, so the May 11th email makes that clear from National Union's perspective that we haven't decided we're going to take over the appeal. And in fact, the other insurers submitted evidence which on its face shows that there was this issue had not been resolved. And that's a May 17th, 2004 email from Rockwell to National Union, which is in the record 51-5. And that email specifically discusses that it was Rockwell's assumption that National Union would want to take over the defense of the case given the exposure. But that within that email itself, it acknowledges that this issue was unresolved, that National Union was taking a different position, it was unresolved, and that the parties would need to continue to discuss this, and they'd set up future meetings to discuss that issue. But there was no evidence in the record after that that there was ever any agreement between Rockwell and National Union to actually transfer control of the case. Everything that's been submitted by the other insurers is essentially circumstantial evidence to try to suggest that there was some agreement to transfer the case.
Well, let's talk about the settlement negotiations because their position is that National took over control of the settlement negotiations. And didn't Rockwell make its $2 million self-insured retention available to National? And then Travelers authorized National to use its $1 million excess policy toward the settlement? And that all made sense given that National was responsible for the next $50 million in coverage.
It all makes sense.
Because it provided the third tier of insurance for Rockwell.
Yes, excuse me, Your Honor. It does make sense in terms of trying to settle the case, but Rockwell's actual tender, which is the January 26, 2004 letter, which is at the record 1213, that letter expressly states that the tender is being made for purposes of settlement negotiations only, which means it's not being tendered as that we're tendering the whole control of the defense of the case. They're simply tendering it so National Union can use that money to try to settle the case, because National Union can't offer anything above the $2 million until it has authority from Rockwell to do that. And essentially, Rockwell has given them authority to use the $2 million for settlement purposes. National Union then accepted on a January 23rd, 2004 email, and again in a May 11th, 2004 email, both of those stated we're accepting the $3 million for settlement purposes only.
Now, the appeal was briefed and argued, I presume. Was it?
The appeal was fully briefed and argued.
And in the meantime, lots of settlement negotiations, I presume.
I'm not aware that there was any.
You had certain deadlines to file your appeal. I don't know what the rules are of that state, but I assume that all along, whatever they're doing, they're talking about settlement at the same time somebody's writing the brief and preparing for argument.
I'm not aware, Your Honor, of any evidence that was in the record that there was continued negotiations.
Okay, well, whenever they stopped, they were going on. Who paid for the appeal?
The
attorneys and all that.
National Union voluntarily agreed to pay for the appellate counsel's attorney's fees. Again, that's a they're trying, what the other insurers would like to say is that's essentially evidence that you've assumed the defense of the case, that you've agreed. There's agreement between Rockwell and National Union to transfer the control of the defense of the case. National Union's agreement just to pay appellate counsel's fees was just simply that. It was an equitable matter. We believe we can stand on the contract terms just like the other insurers and say we're not going to pay anything. But as a matter of equity, we believe it's fair and we're going to offer to pay for appellate counsel's fees. There's also a practical purpose in general for an excess insurer like National Union to do that. So as you say, they have a large exposure. They want to make sure that the best appellate counsel is hired, that they're adequately being paid and doing the work that needs to be done. But that is not evidence that mere payment is not evidence that there was an agreement between Rockwell to relinquish control, its right to control the defense, or an agreement by National Union to assume that obligation to control the defense of the case. Simply an agreement for National Union to voluntarily pay the fees, and they've not sought those fees back.
Like you said, there's lots of circumstantial evidence, at least in my view, that National was really controlling this. But I guess my question is, did National ever state that they were not assuming Rockwell's defense to all parties involved in the litigation?
I believe they stated that with respect to when they retained the first appellate attorney, there was a correspondence, a May 10th letter from National Union stating that this was not We had hired Kloss and Miller firm to come in and just to assist in the trial as part of our rights to participate, and we are not, this is not us trying to take over control of the defense of the case. There's specific evidence on that. There's no...
So they said in writing they were not assuming Rockwell's defense.
In so many terms, yes.
So those words were used?
Well, not the words assuming the defense. It was the words were used that they were not hired as appellate counsel. This does not change our legal obligations under the contracts. They are being retained just to simply assist in the defense of the case, not to take control of the case. But again, you know, you mentioned this is circumstantial evidence, and what we're talking about here, this motion for summary judgment was attached to an initial motion to dismiss the case. No discovery had been done in the case. There's clearly just on the correspondence alone, based on the May 17th correspondence and the two emails between National Union and Rockwell, there's a clear question of fact, and it's a jury question as to whether or not there's ever any understanding between Rockwell and National Union to transfer control of the defense. All this other evidence is circumstantial evidence, but that's a jury question. That was for a jury to decide whether that circumstantial evidence is enough to come to the conclusion that there was an assumption of the defense. But we never got to that. There was never any discovery, and there's never any fact-finding on that. The court just made the conclusion themselves as a fact-finder that National Union had assumed the defense despite contrary evidence. I see my time is up, and I'll reserve it for rebuttal. We didn't get to the contract construction issue. It's important as well. If the court has any specific questions on that, I could address that now.
Well, you're into your rebuttal now, so you don't have very much time left.
Okay. Well, you know, I will. I'll just reserve for rebuttal at this point then. Thank you.
Mr. Schenck.
Please, the court. There are two legal issues here that are very straightforward. First, is post-judgment interest covered under the insuring agreement of the policies at issue? If not, National Union cannot recover from Federal and Gulf, and the judgment below should be affirmed. Second, whether on the undisputed facts, including that National Union retained and paid for Rockwell's appellate counsel, National Union assumed Rockwell's defense. If so, National Union owes all of the post-judgment interest, and it cannot recover from Federal and Gulf. Now, before addressing that first legal question, let me briefly touch on choice of law, because National Union makes a lot of choice of law in its briefs. However, National Union admits that there is no conflict of laws on this first legal issue. It conceded that below because there's a dearth of case law on this question. The policies at issue do address post-judgment interest, but in only one place, the supplementary payments provision. And in that provision, an insurer owes post-judgment interest in only one situation, when it assumes the insured's defense. Here, Federal and Gulf did not assume Rockwell's defense. It's not even alleged that they assumed the defense. Therefore, they can't owe post-judgment interest. It's as simple as that.
Can we get back to the choice of law question? Do we need to even reach that issue if we agree that National assumed Rockwell's defense and therefore the district court properly granted summary judgment?
The way I see it is, if you find that post-judgment interest is not covered under the insuring agreement, the case is over. You can affirm on that basis. If you find that it is covered under the insuring agreement, you then go to the next question of whether National Union assumed the defense. If so, it owes all the post-judgment interest anyway, and there's nothing left put into the insuring agreements of Federal and Gulf. So if you get that far and say, yes, it's covered under the insuring agreement, but National Union assumed the defense, there is a conflict of laws between California and basically the rest of the country over what is the consequence of assuming an insurer's defense. In Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Missouri, all the states that we think are relevant here, if an insurer assumes the defense, it owes all post-judgment interest. The courts say the policy means what it says. The policy says you owe all post-judgment interest. All means all. In California, not surprisingly, all doesn't mean all. All means part. And so that's the conflict there. So that's where you would reach a choice of law.
Originally, the dispute was whether Pennsylvania or Wisconsin law applies, and there was really no difference, so the district judge applied Wisconsin law. Where the California thing came, and I know that the National argued that, but where are the contacts with California here?
We argued, the insurers, that either Missouri, where the underlying litigation took place, where the judgment was entered, and where the post-judgment interest accrued under Missouri statute applied, or Pennsylvania law applied because the policies were made in Pennsylvania. National Union Insurance Company of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, issued a policy that is endorsed with an endorsement that says a mandatory Pennsylvania endorsement. It's a Pennsylvania contract. So we thought either Missouri or Pennsylvania law applies. They're both the same as Wisconsin law, so there was no conflict, and Judge Adelman agreed, so the Judge Adelman applied Wisconsin law. National Union argued, however, California law should apply because of a single contact. Midway through the National Union policy period, a revised declaration page was issued for that policy, whereas when the policy was first issued, it listed Rockwell International at a Pennsylvania address. The revised declaration page issued months after the policy was in effect listed Rockwell at a new California address. But that really doesn't have anything to do with where the policy was negotiated or issued or where the insured risks are located. And Judge Adelman agreed that that one single contact is overwhelmed by all of the Pennsylvania contacts at issue. So let me briefly touch on the insuring agreement. It covers legal liability the insured has because of property damage. Now, Mr. Fink mentioned only that it covers the legal liability of the insured. He omits the rest of that insuring agreement, which says because of property damage. Post-judgment interest is not legal liability of the insured because of property damage. It's incurred as a penalty for a delay in satisfying a judgment. Now, that judgment may be because of property damage, but the post-judgment interest is not. You can avoid post-judgment interest altogether by prompt satisfaction of the judgment. The supplementary payments provision in the National Union policy itself describes post-judgment interest as an expense, not as damages, which would be covered under the insuring agreement. Now, National Union claims this would create a silent exclusion in the policy for post-judgment interest. Not so. Typically, you're going to have a primary insurance policy and excess layers above it. All of those policies in modern times have a supplementary payments provision. One of those insurers will be defending, so one of those insurers will owe the post-judgment interest under their supplementary payments provision in addition to limits. So this is not a question of whether there is or is not coverage in the broad sense for post-judgment interest. It's just a question of which layer will respond. National Union argues it's all the layers above it. We argue it's National Union because they assume the defense. The Hooters case is the only case that's really on point here, and that is directly on point. It has the same policy language and really involved the same issues. The court there rejected the position that post-judgment interest is covered under the insuring agreement because it said if we found that way, it wouldn't give effect to the supplementary payments provision, which expressly addresses post-judgment interest and limits the insurer's liability, therefore, to situations where it has assumed the defense. In its brief, National Union tries to distinguish Hooters on two bases. First, well, it says Hooters had a primary policy. Rockwell was self-insured. So what? When you self-insure at the primary layer, you're essentially acting as your own primary insurer. You keep all of the liability you might otherwise transfer to your primary insurer, which includes liability for post-judgment interest. So Rockwell had that liability unless one of its excess carriers stepped in and assumed the defense. Fortunately for Rockwell, National Union did. National Union also tries to distinguish Hooters on the fact that it was decided under Georgia law, which is not like California law on certain issues. But again, National Union admitted and concedes the conflict of laws is not an issue with respect to this question of whether post-judgment interest is covered under the insuring agreement. In contrast, National Union can't cite to really any cases on point. It cites to a whole host of prejudgment interest cases, but those cases are not applicable. Prejudgment interest is not the same as post-judgment interest. The courts are very clear about that. Prejudgment interest is compensatory, where post-judgment interest is routinely considered punitive or a penalty for failure to satisfy a judgment. Cases cited by National Union itself, the Allstate v. Allen case and the Farm Bureau versus Milne case, emphasized the clear distinctions between pre- and post-judgment interest. And in those two cases, which were addressing pre-judgment interest, the court said, we're not going to look at the post-judgment interest cases because they're irrelevant to pre-judgment interest. The converse is true as well. Also, I think it's very important to note, National Union argues, well, pre-judgment interest is routinely covered under the insuring agreement, so post-judgment interest should be as well. But the cases that National Union has cited for that proposition are dealing with old policy forms that either had no supplementary payments provision at all or had supplementary payments provisions that did not mention prejudgment interest. So in those cases with old forms, the court was put to the choice of either finding coverage for prejudgment interest under the insuring agreement or finding no coverage at all.
Can you tell me, how did the prejudgment interest get so high in this case, $18 million?
Oh, the post-judgment interest.
Post-judgment interest, rather. How did it get so high?
$190,000 judgment was entered on a $97 million verdict, which the court brought down to $190,000. It went up on appeal. The appellate court reinstated the $97 million and decided that post-judgment interest would accrue back from the date of the original judgment. So basically, the post-judgment interest accrued during the two-year appellate process.
I understand, but why wouldn't the judgment just accrue on the $190,000 and not on the $97 million if the trial judge entered judgment for $190,000?
That's a question I'm sure Rockwell's asking itself, and that's not an issue for us. And I don't know the answer to that other than it's perhaps a peculiarity of Missouri law, but the Missouri Appellate Court found that we're going to run the post-judgment interest on the full $97 million from the date of the original jury verdict. And Rockwell opposed that, but they lost. So that's how it got so big. Yeah. Let me now talk about the assumption of the defense. National Union's briefs, and here today, they talk about control, that National Union didn't have exclusive control, is the term they used, of the appeal. He used the term here today, veto power. If you look in National Union's policy, the term exclusive control appears nowhere. The term that's used in the supplementary payments provision is assume. If National Union assumes the defense, it owes all post-judgment interest. So assumption is the operative concept. Now, National Union assumes that it did not assume the defense, but there are several undisputed facts that show that it did. National Union was the first to contact appellate counsel. National Union at the time recognized it had no duty to pay for appellate counsel, yet it proposed that National Union, Federal, and Rockwell share appellate counsel. Federal declined. Nonetheless, National Union went forward with retaining Ms. Robertson as Rockwell's appellate counsel. Ms. Robertson substituted in and became Rockwell's appellate counsel, and National Union paid all of her fees. Those facts are undisputed. Now, all the other collateral facts that National Union argues are still in dispute really don't matter because that core basic fact that they retained and paid for appellate counsel who substituted in is more than enough to show that they assumed the defense and to sustain.
And when that counsel that substituted in for Paul Ross, and that was because some conflict had arisen?
Yes, I notice I'm into my time. Let me answer your question. Ms. Cole Ross was retained by National Union to assist at the trial level with jury verdict, jury instructions, post-trial motions, and I think it was expected that she'd be appellate counsel. She had a conflict, so then the question became, who else will we hire as appellate counsel? National Union retained and paid for Ms. Robertson to then take that role. Thank you.
Mr. Gilligan, you have a couple of minutes.
Thomas Gilligan on behalf of Travelers Indemnity Company. And one thing I want to point out is there is a difference between Travelers and Gulf for the purpose of the underlying case. And in the brief of National Union, they tend to use Travelers a bit generously. And just focus, when you're taking a look at that brief, on who is Travelers and who is Gulf. When I say Travelers, I mean Travelers. When I say Gulf, I mean Gulf.
Gulf is, makes it very clear.
Well, it's an important difference because in this situation, we've talked a lot about the National Union policy, but let's talk about the Gulf policy. The Gulf policy had an attachment point at $103 million. So we've got the self-insured retention, the fronting policy of $1 million, and then the two $50 million excess policies. And no matter what happens here, because there was a $97.6 million judgment, nothing reaches Gulf because of the language in its policy, because it says that the liability of the company shall not attach until the insured or the insured's underlying insurer has paid the amount of the underlying insurance, and that's $100 million. Gulf isn't responsible for the judgment because Federal didn't exhaust its policy, and so that's unique to Gulf.
Let me go back since we're clarifying things. Travelers didn't. Did Travelers join Federal's motion for summary judgment?
Travelers did not join the motion.
But when the court entered summary judgment, it was also in favor of both parties. And if we agree that National assumed Rockwell's defense, can we still affirm on that ground as to both parties?
I think you can, Your Honor, because of Rule 12D, because the judge considered a great deal of factual information outside of the pleadings. And there were motions back and forth between National Union and Federal on summary judgment.
So you don't think it's a problem just in terms of Travelers, because that's really where it goes to. You really, Travelers really hadn't joined.
That's correct.
Okay.
The other thing I want to point out that's unique to Travelers is the whole choice of law concept doesn't make any difference with respect to Gulf. In this situation, none of the judgment was within Gulf's limits. And therefore, if you're applying Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, which talks about the fact that the primary or the first excess is going to pay all the interest, or if you go to any of these other states that say they're only going to pay part, it doesn't make any difference because it never reaches Gulf's level.
Let me just follow up a little on my earlier question. So why is it you think we can still affirm? Just because of the nature of what the district court took into account, and that because there was some confusion on the briefing? Or?
Well, that's one thing. The second thing, Your Honor, is that we did attach the policies. And so if you're comparing what's been claimed to the policies, which are cross-referenced within the complaint, and the cases say you can refer without converting it into a Rule 56 motion, the judge should still be affirmed on that basis. With respect to the whole concept of participation versus assumption, there is no language in the National Union policy that talks about control or exclusive control. What National Union did was they retained paid counsel that substituted. And so the exclusive counsel on the appeal was someone that was paid for by National Union. And if that doesn't constitute an assumption of a defense, I don't know what does. So if it's a situation where you want to draw a bright line and say when counsel is paid for and substitutes for the underlying counsel or the insurance counsel, that's going to trigger an assumption of defense. You could also say on the facts of this case, because of those salient facts, the retention and the substitution and the payment, that's going to constitute an assumption of the defense. The last thing is that, and I think this is important, if you go back and take a look at the National Union policy, it's not just because of property damage. It's also because of property damage and caused by an occurrence. So to say that post-judgment interest constitutes damages under the insuring agreement, in light of that language, simply doesn't hold water. So in the end, all interest should mean all interest. An absent policy language to the contrary, an excess carrier shouldn't be required to pay post-judgment interest where the judgment never reaches its limits and it never assumed the defense of the case. And an insurer shouldn't be able to draft a policy, make choices under that policy, which triggers obligations, and then walks away from those obligations. So on that basis, the dismissal of National Union's cross-claims against Gulf should be affirmed. Thank you.
3 minutes, Mr. Pink.
First, payment alone has never been held to be assumption of the defense of the case. I point to the SIPS case, which talks about strategic litigation decisions. That's what controlling the defense of the case means. To simply have a rule that payment alone or even these other participation, other evidence that they submitted is going to have a chilling effect on insurers. Excess insurers have the right to participate, to get involved in selection of counsel, payment of counsel, participation in the trial, without having to risk that they're going to be deemed to have assumed the defense of the case, which comes along with a lot of other obligations to it, not only post-judgment interest, but fiduciary duties that are owed. And if it's going to be a simple matter of just payment and you've assumed the defense of the case, excess insurers just will step back and not get involved. And having it's a great benefit to the insured and the insurers that they can work together in participating in a trial without having risk the assumption of the defense. Just quickly on the insuring agreement, there is no absolute rule that post-judgment interest follows the party that's defending. It generally does that because the primary policies have a supplemental payment provision. Here, there was no contract governing the self-insured retention. There was no contract saying that Rockwell is obligated to pay post-judgment interest. So you have to look at the excess policies then and say, what is Rockwell's reasonable expectation? They have $150 million in policies, excess policies. They have a risk of only $2 million that they've retained for themselves. Yet, under the district court's decision, if assuming National Union didn't assume the defense and just took the same position everyone else did, we're stepping back, Rockwell would have been obligated to pay $18 million post-judgment interest themselves, which makes no sense when they only had $2 million of liability. They thought they had $150 million of coverage for their legal obligations, which was post-judgment interest, pre-judgment interest, and the judgment. Now, let's point out, the pre-judgment interest was paid by all the other excess insurers, and there is no distinction between pre-judgment interest and post-judgment interest. They're both, the Missouri cases say this, they're both to compensate the claimant for the lost time of money. So there's no distinction that should be made, and they paid the pre-judgment interest within the insuring agreement. If there's any other questions, rest on the brief.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Pink. The case will be taken under advisement. We'll proceed.